The market's just less efficient. And when you start buying the smaller properties, that builds up your reputation, that builds up your track record. People have seen you've closed, as opposed to going to them with nothing and saying, give me a shot. You want to start building that track record on the more manageable stuff.
If you have over $200,000 sitting stagnant in your bank, retirement account, or home equity, then you're literally losing money. On this show, you learn how to get that money working for you consistently and conservatively. Learn to grow your nest egg with your host, Sean Winslow. Let's dive in.
Hey, Will. Welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just get right to it. Everyone loves a good origin story. Looking at your bio here, you started around 2017, 2018. Bought a duplex. You just told me now you're about to close 14th transaction. I believe that's over $100 million of acquisitions. So let's talk about how do you go from a duplex to over $100 million in acquisitions?
Yeah. So our big philosophy when we got started was first acquisition, January 2018. My brother and I, my twin, were 25 at the time. And we know nobody is going to give us a $5 million equity check, and we don't have the network to raise that type of equity, and understandably so to a certain extent. So we're going to do these acquisitions and we're just going to buy, sell really quickly, do heavy value add projects. So people know, hey, look, we know what we're doing. We're capable. We're not just jumping into this. Like, we have a plan. So for the first few years, really all of our acquisitions through 2018, 2019, and 2020 were meant to be buy, sell. So we could build out that track record, solid investor returns. And that's what we did. We bought a 2-unit deal, a 6-unit deal. Then we're buying 15 units, 24 units, 32 units, selling all of them within less than 2 years, roughly. So we could build that track record, so we could attract new investors, so we could build confidence with lenders, with other partners, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of the origin story. We started small and scaling up ever since.
Yeah. And why'd you guys pick multifamily and student housing? You know, there's a lot of asset classes out there.
Yeah. So prior to getting started, we had been brokers at Marcus & Millichap, and we were doing a lot of retail, some multifamily, some student housing. We left that. We went to Columbia University for their master's in real estate development program. And when we were leaving there, we said we wanted to start our own business. We wanted to do our own thing. But starting out at our age, we knew you could not mess up early deals. You needed something rock solid. You didn't want to go retail and have your tenant go bankrupt and then have to re-tenant like a strip center or something like that. So we said, we think multifamily has the highest floor and it's also the easiest one to implement a value add strategy on. You buy a net lease retail property, it might be 2 years before a lease comes due. You don't want to do that. Multifamily, you can buy, you can renovate, you can sell. And obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, that was a great market to get into, a great time to start buying. I only wish we'd bought more.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, man. To your point of having rock solid deals right out of the gate, not having a flop is huge to the trajectory of anyone's career, right? So what are some of the things you would advise someone newer in this game to kind of some of the pitfalls to stay away from?
I've got lists of to-dos and not to-dos. I always find the what not to do is more helpful. And we had done almost all of these by the end of 2019. But I always tell people, you don't want to over allocate your capital into any deals. You're in this business to build a portfolio of real estate. You're not in it to buy one property. Obviously, every time early on, you're thinking, I've got to get this deal. I've got to get this deal. I'll fund everything if that's what it takes. No, you don't want to do that. You don't want to over allocate yourself to any one project. You want to be able to diversify so you can grow your company. You don't want to lock into long-term timeframes. When you're doing your third acquisition, you don't want to say, oh, this is going to be a 7-year hold, because if you're starting small and you're doing this acquisition, 2 years from now, it'll be the smallest property in your portfolio and you'll be wanting to move on to bigger things. So you don't want to lock in long-term on these assets. And the secondary point of that is get flexible prepayments on your debt. If you go yield maintenance on deal, you're kind of forced into that, or you're paying a hefty fee to get out of it. And those things can be pretty brutal. I always tell people, don't do ground up construction either. That is a whole different animal. It takes a long time, especially if you're trying to do it full time. It means a lot when you can buy a property, get an acquisition fee. If it's a small deal, the asset management fees really aren't a ton. So your acquisition fees and your promotes might be your only income. So you want to get in, get out, move quickly.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen that too, especially starting off if it's a longer hold too, right? Bigger part of the promote is on the back end. So it's a long hold and you don't have any cash flow come from anywhere else. That can be tough. Now, I got a question for you on your point on yield maintenance, which is huge. A lot of people are going agency right now, which will have that aspect to it. What are you guys looking at currently from a debt perspective on acquisitions in today's market?
So our outlook is a little different than it was back then. I mean, I'll hold a property longer today than I would have back in 2018, 2020, just because we are more established, just because our capital is a little more patient. I mean, it really does seem like today, if you're not assuming a loan, it's tough to get a good rate out of a bank. It really seems to be agency or maybe LifeCo. I had a discussion with a private equity firm not too long ago where we were sizing up a deal, looking at a couple options. And on paper, proceeds on the 10-year money were better. The rate was lower, but it was a 10-year agency quote earlier this year. The 5-year, again, lower money, a higher interest rate. And our conversation essentially was, hey, look, I know the IRR on the 10-year hold looks better, but there are 8 assumptions. I could model 8 different assumptions on the 5-year money and get to a better outcome. But deep down, we all know that we want this 5-year money. We want the 5-year money. We want to be able to get out in 3 years, refi in 3 years. We do not want to lock in for 10 years. But I mean, the double-edged sword of that is, look, I mean, there are some deals where it might only work with that 10-year money, but if it cash flows, it cash flows. And maybe that's what you end up going with. It's tough to say.
Hey, I think that's a good point right there. It is tough to say, right? And we're changing market. It seems like it's changing every day. So it is tough to say, but I think the flexibility aspect of not getting in locked in too long, unless you have a certain capital stack where that doesn't bother them. But I guess it comes down to that.
Let me just add on. I mean, it really depends because I value the optionality. I want the ability to prepay in 3 years. I want the ability to refinance in 3 years. But if your equity, if you're doing a JV, you're doing a syndication, and let's say you have to lock into a 6% rate for the next 5 years. If your equity is okay with that, and that's what gets the acquisition done, you might be paying 6% interest 4 years in the future. But without that 6% interest, you might not own the property at all. You might not have that investment. So in an ideal world, yeah, we'd all like to have the best prepayments possible. But the era of easy money appears to be over. And as long as people go into it knowing the risks, what gets the deal done gets the deal done.
Yeah. The cash flows and cash flows, right? Weather you through that storm. So,
yeah, I mean, I wouldn't buy a 4 cap with 6% data. Be clear about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in this market, you're not moving the needle enough to make that work. Well, you mentioned you guys primarily Carolinas. How are you guys finding your deals, these off market deals? Obviously, you guys come from a broker background, broker relations. How are you sourcing your deals?
I think every acquisition we've done has come through a broker, but a lot of them have been off market. Obviously, we like to believe, and maybe the brokers will agree, maybe they won't, but I think we've got great relationships with something close to 40 brokers throughout the Southeast that we talk to on a regular basis. We see a lot of properties off market before they hit the market. We very rarely get into competitive bid scenarios because when you're competing with 20 people, that's just a tough business to be in. But the strong majority of our acquisitions have been off market, but all of them have still been through brokers.
Yeah. And I guess you guys had a leg up on that. Someone new into this business, what would you tell them in terms of not only developing a relationship with a broker, but developing a relationship with the right broker? What would you say to that?
So it all depends on where you're coming in. One of the things we did is we started really small. Our first acquisition, like I said, was a duplex, and then it was six unit deal, 15 unit deal. And that's for a few reasons. Number one, if you go out there and you start trying to buy $20, $30 million properties, the brokers who sell $20 and $30 million properties, they already know everybody who buys and owns and sells those properties. So you're facing an uphill battle from the get-go. If you start smaller, one, it's easier to raise the money, but two, the market is typically less efficient. You'll see a deal show up on the MLS every now and then, as opposed to your LoopNets, your CoStars, Crexies, things like that. So, and they're typically more poorly managed the smaller they are. So I would say for starters, the first thing you do is you don't go to CBRE or Cushman Wakefield or JLL. That's not where you want to start out. You want to start out looking on LoopNet, looking at smaller properties. If you find anything on your local MLS, give that a really good hard look. It's either really underpriced or really overpriced. Could be anywhere in the middle. The market's just less efficient. And when you start buying the smaller properties, that builds up your reputation. That builds up your track record. People have seen you've closed, and you buy that $1 million property off of LoopNet or the MLS. Then you buy your $2 million. Then you buy your $3 million. Then you're going to start to get the attention of your Cushmans, your JLLs, when you go to them and say, hey, look, I've actually closed, as opposed to going to them with nothing and saying, give me a shot. You want to start building that track record on the more manageable stuff.
Yeah, definitely. What is your buy box now? Assume it's a little larger than it was back in the duplex days.
It is a little larger than that. I mean, admittedly, our buy box is all over the place. Like I said, we've done joint ventures with private equity firms. We've syndicated acquisitions. Obviously, you want to tell yourself you're always moving forward. I only want to buy 15 plus million, 20 plus million dollar assets. But then a really good $8 million property, you see it, you're underwriting a 30% IRR, and you just can't help yourself. You got to jump right back into it.
Yep. I know how that is. What got you guys into student housing, and why do you like it?
We brokered some student housing back in our Marcus days. We were primarily retail. We did a little bit of student housing. It flows nicely with multifamily. I mean, the buildings are similar enough, but it all depends on the school. Our favorite student housing location, Appalachian State University, Boone, North Carolina, really high barriers to entry to get into the market, supply and demand, very landlord friendly. And one of the things I like about it is it almost operates like a net lease deal. All your leases expire at the same time, but they're pre-leased 6 months in advance. It all depends on the property manager you work with. We work with a group, Boone High Country Rentals. They're phenomenal. It's just a very hands-off, easy asset. I think maybe I'm just fortunate, but the reputation of, oh, it's student housing, they terrorize the dorms, there's holes in all the walls. I mean, you have security deposits. Your tenants are probably a lot more tame than a lot of C-class properties, so I like it. Very predictable.
I think that the places that do have those issues are not the big, nice complexes that like you're buying to have on-site staff. I think that's more of like kids living in a duplex or a six-bedroom house, right? There's no staff on-site and they can do whatever they want when they want. I think that's where those nightmares come from. At least that's from my perspective of owning student housing. I agree with you. To your point, the property manager and management company is an integral part. Once you get that rolling, you're right. It should just run like a nicely oiled machine. Yeah. And I do love that it's all the leases at the same time, pre-lease 6 months in advance. And generally, there's a co-applicant that's a parent that generally has a really high credit score and income. That doesn't hurt either.
Yeah, no, it definitely doesn't hurt. And again, like I said, if you have good supply and demand, if everyone's pre-leasing months in advance, that's phenomenal. I have seen some assets where it's grad student housing. That's a lot tougher to deal with because people don't even know they're going to these programs. They don't get admitted until April and your leases start in August. You have no pre-leasing. It depends on the school. It depends on what their on-campus housing is. But if you can find good opportunities, I think it's a really simple property where for the majority of the year, seemingly nothing happens. It's great. Multifamily, something happens every week.
That's true. And to your point too, like with grad school, they're only there for like a year or two. So it's higher turnover. One of the good things about student housing for undergrad is you can lock them in sophomore year and keep two more, total 3 years. That's great. Less turnover.
Maybe even more than 3 years. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe the Van Wilder, they got to stay a couple of years after. That's great. So for you and your brother, what are your goals? What's the future look like? What do you guys want to achieve?
I mean, the goal is always just continue to grow, continue to acquire more, continue to service the investors we have, but also continue to grow our investor base. We've been very fortunate. We sold most of our portfolio in Q4 21 to Q1 22.
Great timing.
Yeah, you know, we locked in some gains. Got to put some nice IRRs on the track record. We're not burdened with any floating rate debt, anything like that. We're pretty clean spot right now. So we just want to continue growing our portfolio and taking it to the next level.
Yeah, you know, talking about floating rate, obviously, that's phenomenal. You don't have any right now, but do you think you'd ever use it in the future or have you used it in the past? Reason I ask is I've seen studies where over the long term, floating rate is better in terms of what you pay in interest, right? Obviously, it comes down to time.
Are you talking about the thing that J.P. Conklin put together, like 98% of the time, floating rate is better?
No, it wasn't J.P. Conklin. I'll try to find it and link it in the show notes. But no, it was some institution put it together. It was like a 50-year study. Maybe that's what he was alluding to.
JP Conklin on the Rate Guy podcast, Pensford Capital, he talks about, I think it was 40 years, 98% of the time, floating rate debt is better. I'm fortunate that none of the assets we control, we did some acquisitions where we're not the lead sponsor, so we do have a little floating rate debt there. I could see using floating rate debt in the future, especially at a time like now when pretty much everyone agrees maybe they'll go 25 basis points higher, but everyone seems to think we've hit the peak. The idea of locking in for the next 6 years or 7 years, 5 years, whatever, at 6% when everyone is forecasting cuts coming in 24, 25, possibly even the end of 23, I think there could be a lot of opportunities in floating rate debt. But the last time I saw that, you could get a lower fixed rate interest rate than you could get on a floating rate. I mean, that makes it tough too.
Yeah, that's true. It's all about timing, right?
Pre-rate hikes, the floating rate debt was lower than the fixed rate debt. So to have the floater be higher, even when people are forecasting going down, that's kind of tough to stomach. But yeah, I think there could be a lot of opportunity in that space.
Yeah. And talking about the future, are you guys currently vertically integrated in any way? And if not, do you ever see yourself doing that?
So we have a great partner that we work with out of Charlotte, North Carolina. His name is Fabio Nogueira, Stintino Capital. He is incredible with owner managing properties. So we've done about five or so projects with him, and we want to continue growing with him in that sense on the conventional side. Student housing, I'm very clear, hire a student housing management company for all the reasons we talked about. All your leases sign at the same point. If you mess up one leasing cycle in student housing, you could be headed straight for foreclosure.
Oh, yeah.
Leave that to the professionals. You've got one turn cycle where you might have to turn 40% of your units in 2 weeks. No, thank you. I want the Gray Stars or whoever of the world, when they call a contractor, that contractor shows up because there's 10 other properties in the market that they want business from, whereas little old me trying to turn 40 units in 2 weeks, probably the last guy they're calling back. So yeah, owner management and multifamily, that's one thing. Owner management and student, whole different level.
I'm with you. And just the scale you get from working with a bigger company, right? From material standpoint, it makes a big difference as well. At least I think it does. So you guys are in, is it both Carolinas, North and South?
I've owned in South Carolina previously. I've owned three assets in South Carolina, but we've sold them all. We've been trying to buy again. We sold all of our South Carolina properties in 2021. Have not been able to find a new one that really excited us. So currently our entire portfolio is in North Carolina, though we are looking in Virginia, Georgia, Tennessee. Who knows? We'll be competing on a deal one of these days. We'll work together. We'll see.
Hey, I'd love to, man. I'd love to. In terms of anything that excites you, are you guys seeing anything? For us, we're starting to see a little more excitement. But if you asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said no. Are you guys seeing anything that excites you? Well, obviously you have because you're closing here soon. But besides that deal.
Yeah. So I actually, maybe I'm being a contrarian here, but everyone has this mindset that the real opportunities are going to be coming 6 months, 9 months from now. There's going to be a recession in the future. All the bridge debt is going to come due and tons of people are going to be forced to sell. I'll be honest, I don't think pricing is going to get much better than it is today. If you talk to a broker, they're telling you, yeah, pricing's down 15 to 20% from where it would be. I don't think it's going to get that much lower because, I mean, I don't know which firms you're talking to, but a lot of the times, like let's say Cushman CBRE, they list a deal, they get 20 offers.
Yeah.
And that's with a bunch of people sitting on the sideline. There's so much dry powder. There's so much pent up demand to get back in the game. I think these things are going to get bid up. And on top of that, if we're at the peak of rates, if we hit a recession, people think rates are going to get cut. They think financing is going to be easier. You're saying that financing will be easier, interest rates will be lower, demand will be higher because every group out there is saying, oh yeah, just wait, dry powder, we're going to deploy then. I think the opportunity is today. If it's hard to finance, if not a lot of people are looking, if prices are down, those are all the dimensions for getting a good buy. As soon as everyone else starts bidding, I don't see the bottom falling out.
If that makes you a contrarian, I guess I'm a contrarian with you because I've been beating that drum, man. If there really is this amazing buying opportunity coming, then to your point, everyone's going to jump on it, right? Especially with how connected the world is and how efficient markets are now because data moves so fast. Like, yeah, maybe back in the day because there would be a lag information, but today, no, that's not the case. And as soon as something like that happens, and to your point of if rates are going to get better, liquidity is going to free up, then yeah, of course, it's just going to drive prices back up.
Oh, okay. This is just making me so happy. I'm glad I can talk to somebody else about this one, because for the life of me, I just don't think it's really going to become that much rosier on the outside, because everybody says this, and you talk to brokers maybe a few months ago, maybe it's not the case anymore. They would tell you 80% of buyers have stopped calling. Let's all remember in 2000, look, I was in high school at the time, but you have the great financial crisis, the great recession, all that happened. It's not like people were flooding back in to the market immediately, but everyone was terrified at that point. Everyone was looking at this saying the recession's not going to be that bad. It's like a mild recession, whatever the case may be. But even, let's say 80% of people aren't looking right now, half of those people will still talk themselves out. Even if a recession hits, they'll say, oh, well, it's going to get worse. Half of them will still say that. But even if 40% of buyers are getting back in, you've tripled the buyer pool. It's just, I don't see it. I just don't see it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. But to your point of there's so much dry powder on the sidelines too that I don't see it falling out. Yeah, I'm with you.
Well, also, we have a housing shortage still. I mean, I know some Southeastern MSAs have a lot of new deliveries coming on board, but one of the problems leading up to the financial crisis was you had this huge housing supply boom. People are building, people are buying these negatively amortizing loans, second house, third house. We've all seen The Big Short, neighborhoods where no one actually lived there, et cetera, et cetera. We're undersupplied on housing. It never, I shouldn't say never, but it's so expensive to build. It's always harder to build. Land prices are becoming scarcer and scarcer. You cannot build a house in America and sell it for less than $250,000. I can't remember which podcast. I think it was Red Shoe Economics on the Capstone Multifamily Method podcast talking about there are no new build homes in America for sale for less than $250,000. It might have been less than $300,000. You just can't build cheap housing in this country anymore.
No, you can't.
Yeah, the bottom's just not going to fall out. Or I predict it will not fall out. Watch me be wrong.
Hey, if you're wrong, you're there to come in, right? Yeah, man, not only is it more expensive to buy a house, both because it costs more, but it's also cost more because of the rate, but also living expenses have gone up. It's causing people to stay in as renters. And I think that's going to fuel it for anyone who invests in multifamily. And to your point of talking to brokers, we've transacted, obviously, with brokers. So when you get to that point, to this earlier, they show you off-market deals or what is off-market to them. And even so, man, I'll see them early and they won't take an offer because the seller wants to go full cycle. And they're getting a bunch of bids. So it's still there, not to the point it was 12, 18 months ago. But yeah, I just think it's going to continue along like that. That's kind of my outlook on it.
Well, yeah. And I mean, bringing this full circle to our conversation about debt, and would you really lock in if you can positively lever a deal with 6% debt in today's market? Yeah, you might look back and you're, if it's a 7-year hold, you might be 5 years in and looking at it and saying like, oh man, the debt could be so much cheaper. Well, if the debt is that much cheaper, then when you go to sell, you are going to be in a phenomenal spot. People think, oh, it's really risky to invest now. If you can get a deal to work with today's debt, then if rates go down, you're absolutely golden. The time to have been worried was when everyone was buying a 3-cap with floating rate bridge debt. That was all going to come due in 2 years. If you are locking in security for the next 5 years, even if you're paying 6% debt, it can't get much more secure than that. It can't get much safer than that. Yeah, maybe you lose a little bit of the upside. But again, you and I both think markets are so efficient. It's not like everyone's going to be underwriting 30% IRRs. Our team will underwrite a Cushman Wakefield deal. This is a compliment to the Cushman guys. They have such strong market share. We underwrite a Cushman deal every single time. It's a 17 IRR. It's an 18 IRR. Like clockwork, because the entire industry underwrites to IRRs. So if a flood of properties were to hit the market in Q4, guess what? Every one of them is going to be underwritten to an 18 IRR. The brokers know what they're doing. They're smart. They make an efficient market. And I don't just say that because I used to be one.
Well, yeah, they know the game. Yeah, and Southeast Cushman is the big player too. They do know that market share. And that's a good point. And I think that's another reason to rely on brokers too. Like obviously everything anyone says, you got to take with a grain of salt, but they're there to transact. They want to do deals on both sides of the table, right? So they want you to come back. They don't want to feel like you got burned, and they're pricing it to the market, to your point of an efficient market. So going forward, man, just keep plugging away. Like, what kind of advice would you give to someone that's maybe not like we are and is a little skeptical what's about to come?
I mean, we're going to keep looking at opportunities. It's one of those things. You look at 100 properties and you think there's nothing out there. There's nothing out there. There's nothing out there. But the 101st one shows up and it jumps off the page. You know, if you're doing 4-6 acquisitions a year, you can do 2 acquisitions a year, depending on the size of your farm. It's a tremendous year. So what else are you going to do? You're going to keep looking. You're not going to try to make bad investments, obviously. That goes without saying, but there's always opportunities out there. Someone is going to get squeezed with a floating rate loan that needs to be refinanced in 3 months. You're going to call a broker on the right day, right as they got a T12 in front of them, and they're going to say, hey, look, this might be for you. So we're going to keep looking. I mean, really, at the end of the day, unless something dramatically changes in terms of our ability as a country to build more affordable housing, the supply and demand dynamics for apartments are going to remain strong. And I think that's going to make them remain a strong investment. Not that we're going to have a repeat of 2020 where everyone gets a 30 IRR every single time. The last 10 years, not 2020, the last 10 years where every deal is a 30 IRR at a minimum. But we'll see things normalize. We'll see 15%, 18%, 20% IRRs on a routine basis.
Yeah, man. And I think your points of just keep calling, right? I've called brokers who just happened to be on the right day. I called them and they just got a deal in front of them and I got to look at it first. Yeah, you can call that lucky, but if I hadn't called, I wouldn't have been lucky. So the point is just to keep calling and stay top of mind. I think in anything that's going to benefit you. And plus, when deal does come, you're top of mind. They're going to send it to you.
Well, I'll give this bit of advice, and this one is important, which is you actually want to be interesting to talk to, because brokers, I don't know how many people they talk to. It could be 50 a day, it could be 20, it could be 100 a day. But if you're just going to them and you ask the same 3 questions every time, hey, have anything I should look at or whatever the case may be, you very quickly just become another number in the phone. Brokers are people too. We all have people who call us where you say, oh no, not again. You've got to be interesting to talk to. I'm not saying I always am, but I try to at least be somewhat entertaining.
Yeah, of course. And again, you want to do business with people you like. So don't just talk business, talk personal stuff. You know, and then when you transact, maybe you can go do something fun, right? That's a dinner, a game, whatever it happens. I think that's great advice. Man, before we end here, before I ask like the last couple of questions here, any advice you'd give either someone that's getting into the game or maybe a little bit seasoned that we haven't talked about?
Well, I said you should start small. I'm a big believer in that one. Unless you're coming out with a fund with capital to deploy because you just left Blackstone after 20 years, you definitely want to start small, work in your local market. If your investors are all based in, I don't know, Atlanta, Georgia, I'd probably start by looking in Atlanta. It's going to be easiest to get the confidence with them in a local market. Counterintuitive, don't build a website until you have a portfolio. There's no need to advertise how little you own. That's another counterintuitive one. People say, I got to build a website. I got to look official. Look, get the email address. That's not a Gmail. 100% do that.
Yeah.
But you own one property. Like, we didn't get a website until we had bought, I don't know, 7-8 properties because we didn't want to broadcast, this is our duplex, this is our 6 unit. We wanted to have something that really stood out. Before I do every one of these podcasts, my brother tells me, hey, look, remember, you're not funny. Your jokes don't come across very well in this format. But I will say, when it comes to naming a company, capital, obviously, people will say it's generic, but you can't go wrong with color noun. I mean, it works for BlackRock, Blackstone, Greystar. You name your company color noun, Greenbrier. I mean, that's, there you go.
Hey, man.
Same thing.
Came from the finance world.
Can't go wrong with color noun.
Yeah, right? Well, that's funny. That's a good one. All right. Well, before I ask the last questions here, where can people find you? Where can they reach out to you?
So I'm pretty easy to find. I like to think on LinkedIn, just Will Matheson, Matheson Capital. And you can also find us on our website, which is mathcap.com, mathcap.com. And yeah, feel free, reach out, send us a message, message me on LinkedIn, however that may be.
Yeah. Hey, you got the capital in the name, just not the color. Love it.
I'll give you one guess on where our name came from.
That's funny. If those don't know, it's his last name, but you probably will by the title of the episode. All right, last questions here. The first part of this question you kind of already answered, but I always ask this question. Why multifamily is an investment vehicle, and what kind of life has it created for you and your brother?
Well, why multifamily? Like you said, I think it has the highest floor of any asset class. Enough said, I think it has a lot of upside. I think the supply and demand dynamics. We invest in the Southeast, not only because I'm originally from South Carolina. I've lived in Georgia, I've lived in North Carolina, I now live in South Carolina. All the supply and demand, the population growth, all of that is great. But as for the life it's given me, I mean, you can't see, but I'm in my office. It's a very narrow, long room. My twin brother and my best friend's desk is on the other side of this room. I work with my twin brother every single day. It's truly great. We provide a lot of value to our investors, have a lot of happy investors. It's phenomenal. I really enjoy it.
Awesome, man. Next question, you kind of already answered too, but what's a common mistake you see a lot of other operators and investors make?
I mean, I think they try to go too big too soon. I think they get in here and they say, oh yeah, I'm going to go buy this $10, $15 million property. And look, there are people, and I'm legitimately impressed for the people who go out there and they raise $5 million on their first deal. If you can do that, more power to you. That wasn't where we came from. But again, start small, build up that track record, deliver the results. You're going to learn a lot of mistakes along the way. Like I said, I have a list of five things I tell people not to do when they're starting out. And I'm pretty sure we did four of them in our first 2 years in business. Still made it through, still were able to get some good returns for the investors, but you're going to learn a lot. There's always something you don't know that you don't know.
So true. And that's why I got to keep going, right? Fall forward. What's a great resource? Where would you send people if they wanted to learn about the industry? Where would you send them to learn?
I'm going to be honest, that is a really difficult question. I mean, obviously, other than podcasts like yours, I'm a big advocate of going through podcasts. I'm not a huge fan of mentoring programs, admittedly. Like, I know people have them. Some people have had success with them. But I talked to this, done a handful of these podcasts with people like you. You can get so many insights into how people run their businesses, how they started, how they raise money, all this stuff just by listening to it. I'm a huge advocate, and primarily they're free. So
yeah, exactly. Love that. Great return on your investment right there, right? Just your time. Last question here for you, Will. The good old time machine question. And I kind of angle this more towards personal finance because I think that's an important aspect to anyone's life, right? And that's kind of my background too. So if you had a time machine, you and your twin brother could hop in it together and go back in time. What's one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self in terms of personal finance, something that you could kind of change the trajectory of their life?
I mean, other than investing in Bitcoin in 2010, which still, that one's going to haunt me. I mean, I feel bad for saying it. I wish I'd been more aggressive in terms of starting to buy back when I was a broker. I started brokerage in 2015. I didn't buy anything until 2018. It's never too young to start investing and taking control of your own future. There's self-directed IRAs and things along those lines that people can touch, as opposed to just, look, over the long run, putting your money in the stock market is a great idea. I believe diversification, all of that stuff. But you can do the house flipping, or you buy your house, you live in it for 2 years, then you rent it for five, the next 3 years, you sell it for the capital gains reasons. There's just so much you can do if you start young. Always be proactive in terms of that. You never want to be passive.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Unless you're an investor in Matheson Capital or Greenbox, right? But that's still you choosing to invest. It's not just...
That's still active, right? Active decision.
Yeah, you have to make that choice. Yeah, there you go.
I love it, man. It's been a great show, man. I really appreciate your time. I know you're a busy guy. So thank you for coming on today.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, everybody. We'll catch you on the next one.
Hey, this is Sean Winslow. After being in the financial service industry for years and having candid conversations with good people just like you, I realized that so many of us are wanting an investment strategy that provides solid returns and consistent income without the bumps in the road. There's little known secret that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. There is an investment out there that is less volatile and the returns are stronger. Get more details by going to greenbriercg.com and clicking on the free e-report. And by the way, if this show has provided you any value, then feel free to leave an honest written review and, of course, share it with a friend who needs it. See you next week for another great show.